Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Narrows podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Tim Miller.
Hi, everyone.
Our guest today is a judge who's also in recovery from addiction, which I bet is very rare, Mary Beth O'Connor. A very Irish name, but you're American.
I'm American, but I do have the Irish colouring, so.
You do, actually. Can you tell us about your Irish ancestry or the connection?
Yeah, my ancestors on the O'Connor side came over before the Civil War during one of the potato famines. And until my grandfather, everyone was 100% Irish, but then we became Americanized and now I'm a mutt. But I am still 25% Irish and I carry the coloring and the name.
Have you been over here?
No, but we do have plans to come over in 2024, 2025.
At least you can prove you're Irish anyway with that name, O'Connell.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah, and Mary, in America, Mary Beth is a Catholic name, especially in the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey, so my whole name is pretty darn Irish American, yeah.
You have an absolutely amazing story as well, and we're just going to get into it a little bit. But we'll start off basically just give us a little bit of context in relation to what it was like for you growing up. Where you lived and who was in the household growing up, and just give us a little bit of an understanding of how it was for you. So whenever you're ready, just jump in there and show.
Sure. I mean, I say the short version is child abuse led to child addiction, right? I mean, it's a too common story. My mother wasn't really connected to me. In fact, I was left at the nunnery for the first 6 months of my life because she wasn't allowed to bring me home because she wasn't married. And later, one time, I lived for 3 years with a great grandmother. And my mom could be violent, but it really got a lot worse when she married my stepfather when I was 9. And he was really violent with her, and he was physically and sexually violent with me. And it was just that kind of household where you never knew what was going to happen, and you're always on eggshells, always under stress. I tell the example of when I was young and I realized how threatening he was, how, you know, violent he could be. I taught my little sister that when we put the dishes away from the dishwasher, that we had to do it one dish at a time, so it didn't clack. Like, that was the level of stress that we were adapting to. So picking up drugs early seemed like a good idea at the time.
I can imagine how a child's nervous system must be when they're dealing with something like that in the family household, the fear of something that could kick off at any moment within the household. How did you actually deal with that fear?
You know, I mean, at first I thought, okay, well, he just has new rules. Let me try to adjust, you know, we weren't allowed to go barefoot in the house. Well, I'd always gone barefoot. Okay, I can adjust, you know, but over time I realized that it really wasn't related to what I did, that my actions were not the primary driver. I could do the same thing 10 times and it was fine. And the 11th time it was like I did the worst thing in the world and I would get a beating. And so it created a lot of anxiety. I also felt, as the oldest, you know, protective towards my sister. And also even watching my mother get beaten, watching someone in your family get assaulted is a trauma in and of itself. The police would come once in a while, but this was the 70s and they would just tell them to cool off or go away for a while. But it was just a constant strain. I mean, nothing might happen for 2 or 3 weeks. It's just that it was unpredictable and out of my control.
You know, back here, in like Ireland is a Catholic country, so and back in your era, let's say in the 70s, where the Catholic Church would have a real stronghold on the community and the country and policy and morality and all that stuff. So when you say the shame for your mother giving birth to a child out of wedlock, like, we understand that here. In Ireland, we had places like the Magdalene laundries and different mm-hmm. places where women would have to go and work and get really very badly treated. Was it like that in America too? And maybe can you talk to us about maybe the stress your mother must have been under to leave her child at the nunnery?
Yeah, so I don't think we had an equivalent to the Magdalene houses, which I know, but there was a special system. So my mother got pregnant with me in 1961 when she was 18. And my biological father, there was like a family meeting with my grandparents, my mother, him and his parents. And basically they said they were going to let this derail his life. And so he didn't marry her. They just completely walked away. And my mother, there was a special system the Catholic Church had set up where they had an unwed, I grew up in Central Jersey, she was in Central Jersey, but they had an unwed mother's home in Philadelphia, which is about 15 miles away. And they would route her mail through the Boston diocese. So she said she was in Boston doing something, I'm not sure what. And the church would send her friend's letter, my mother's letters to her friends through the diocese. And the friends got a Boston address. And then the diocese would forward the letters to my mother in this unwed mother's home in Philadelphia. The other thing that was interesting was that she wasn't even allowed to go into the main home for the first month or two because another woman from her area was already there. And so to protect the privacy, she was in this sort of secondary house until that other woman left. And so then she went there and they had medical, you know, she had me. I was born in Philadelphia. But my grandparents wouldn't let her bring me home. They weren't going to allow, an illegitimate child in the house. And so that's how I ended up at the nuns. I lived with a nun a few miles away for about the first 6 months. So there was definitely a concern about protecting, you know, this information and keeping it all secret.
Yeah. So your mother was obviously traumatized at this stage. You know, she'd gone through so much. Was there addiction within the household as well as you were growing up?
So there was gambling addiction. My grandfather had a gambling problem. In fact, one time he forged my grandmother's signature on a second mortgage and they almost lost the house. And my mother had a gambling problem and she had a shopping problem. But the substances was really started with my sister and I. And, you know, most likely because of the level of violence that we experienced. I mean, that trauma in America, we have something called the adverse childhood experiences score. I don't know if you're familiar. I mean, my A score is 7, which is, you know, very high. And so my odds of picking up substances was probably 5 or 6 times than that, you know, the average because of my history.
I can completely relate to a lot of your story myself, you know, growing up in a home like that. And I remember growing up just consistently being just full of fear, not just because of what was probably going on inside the family household, but also when you go up in the streets, I had issues out in the streets because of the way I looked, because of the clothes that I wore, because of the poverty that was in our household. And other kids would have looked down on something. They would look down upon me as in somebody, you know the way it is, kids and bullying and stuff like that. You don't mean it, but it really hurt. Was things like that happening to you as well as a young child out in the streets and stuff?
I mean, I will say that for me, school was actually my one special place. You know, I got a lot of positive attention at school. I always did really well. For example, the library in my grade school, the books in the library were divided by grade. You know, these were the first grader books and the second grader books and the third grader books. And my first grade teacher took me to the librarian and told her I could read any book in the library. Like there was no limit for me. And so it was just that being noticed, like somebody saw me, somebody valued sort of like a natural inherent attribute I had. On the other hand, I did have problems outside the household as far as other assaults. You know, I had I had actually 2 multi-assailant rapes, one at 17 and one at 19, and other, you know, sexual assaults, or I moved in with a violent boyfriend in college. So I had outside the home traumas added to it, but it was really more when I was a teenager and into the college years.
Yeah, because like the childhood traumas probably lead you down the addiction route, but addiction in and of itself is a traumatic experience, you know, to be on the streets, to having to secure illicit drugs, deal with some very dangerous people, and then being under the influence and not being able to have your wits about you and being vulnerable around predators and stuff like that. I worked in homeless services and drug and alcohol services here in Cork City, and you'd see the women especially are especially more vulnerable when they're under influence, you know, stuff like that.
That's true. It's true. I mean, you're at risk. And it's also that I wasn't taught to sort of value my bodily integrity, right? I wasn't really given the message that I was allowed to make decisions about what happened to my body or to control my body. And so I didn't really even know exactly how to say no. The first time I had sex outside the household, I was 13 and he was 18. And in my mind, this was like a sign of my attractiveness, right? My ability to get somebody. He was, you know, a really good looking guy and popular. But as an adult, I look at it, I'm like, well, that was actually a crime, you know, but I didn't see it that way. I had been sexualized in the home, and I viewed, and my mother really was focused on physical attractiveness, you know, really wanted me to be pretty and bought nice clothes, and was unhappy when I used to have these thick bottle glasses because I had very bad eyesight. But when I was 13, I got contact lenses, and she was so relieved that now I'd be able to get a boyfriend. And so there was this real emphasis on the physical, but also me not knowing how to sort of set boundaries around myself. I just didn't know how to do it.
Yeah, you made a good point there. I seen something on the internet the other day. It was Howard Stern Radio, which was a big thing in America, and Quentin Tarantino was at it, the famous movie director. And they were talking about predators in Hollywood. And Quentin Tarantino was basically making excuses for this person that was after being caught with a 13-year-old girl, saying that it was consensual, she was going to the parties, and Howard Stern was like, she's 13, she's a kid. Like, it doesn't matter if she consented to it, she can't be in a position of consent when she's only a child, you know? And a 13-year-old is a very immature person, and they can't give consent at that age.
Yeah,
that's right. And I didn't understand that. I mean, the modern concept of consent, I'm really so happy to see the conversation around that, not just around age, but that, you know, affirmative consent is a good idea, not just because someone doesn't say no doesn't really mean they're saying yes. Right. There's a difference between silence and yes. And for a lot of us with those sexual assault histories, I think it's harder for us to assert ourselves. And if somebody would ask me a direct question, do you agree? I mean, first of all, I was 13. I might have said yes anyway. But that's really not a decision that's appropriate for me. But even older, it might have been hard, but it would have been, it's interesting to have that idea that there should really, we should really be having that affirmative consent discussion, because it's not, women in particular don't always feel comfortable saying no. And it's also, even with the, you know, the whole thing around sexual assault, one of my sexual assaults, I was like kidnapped, taken off the street by three men in a van. And so when I see on TV where like everybody who gets kidnapped like that is screaming for help, you know, that's not always the right answer. There were three of them, you know, there was actually a gun on me. And also, who was going to hear me most of the time? And so there's these sort of artificial requirements of what we should have to do in order to be able to say that we didn't agree, that are softer. They're lessening now. People have a better appreciation of the breadth of what's permissible and what's actually affirmative consent.
You know, when you started using drugs and stuff and alcohol, how did you feel? How did it make you feel? And what age were you when you started using?
So my first drug was alcohol, which was very common in my day. It was Boone's Hill Strawberry Wine, which is popular sort of sweet wine. And I was 12, and my girlfriend brought it over on her bicycle, like in her little bicycle basket that she had stolen it from her older sister. And what I noticed was that I felt better. You know, it was like a weight was lifted off my shoulder. We were laying on the floor giggling and having a good time. And that caught my attention. You know, this is a positive experience. This makes me feel good. I want more. Yeah. And so I was pursuing alcohol from the beginning. And then I just moved on to other things pretty fast, you know, pot, when, you know, now we'd say weed and pills. I did a lot of acid my sophomore year of high school. And when I was 16, I found my drug of choice, which was methamphetamine. And I was shooting up within 6 months, and I was in full bore addiction in high school. I mean, it was a quick escalation for me.
And that's crystal meth.
Yes, crystal meth.
So what kind of high do people get off crystal meth?
I mean, methamphetamine releases more dopamine in your brain than any of the other drugs. It's, you know, it's a very intense hit. And shooting it is an even more intense hit. And it's interesting. I've thought about this because like you see now, I'm sober. I'm talkative. I'm sort of a little hyper, yeah. high energy. So you'd think that opiates would have attracted me. Let me mellow out. But that isn't what that isn't what attracted me. I'd done opiates. I had done downers, and they were fine, you know. But when I found meth, I became committed. I was committed to meth, like it was my drug. And it was the intensity of the high. But what I also liked was the depth of the crash, because when I would, let's say, was up for 3 days and I went to sleep, I didn't have nightmares. I wasn't tossing and turning. It was like this black pit of sleep. You know, I didn't remember anything. And I had always struggled to how to get my brain to shut off and how to not focus on, you know, hard things. I had struggled with sleep as a child. And so I even liked the crash part of the high, because it was a new sleep without having to struggle getting to sleep or without having nightmares.
And how were you able to fund your drug addiction back then?
You know, I was a young, pretty girl, and so I got a lot of drugs for free. And I started working in high school. You know, I worked, and then when I went to college, I actually did a little better with the meth. I didn't use it as much, but I had that bad multi-assailant rape in college, and moved in with a violent boyfriend. In January of my senior year of college, I picked meth up heavily again, and I used until I was 32. So it was a long haul, which I would work for a while. I say I worked my way down the corporate ladder, right? Because every job, I had a Berkeley degree, which is, you know, an excellent school and good grades, but I couldn't hold a job because I was using all the time. So I was, you know, every job was like less money and less responsibility. And I held it for less time. But I did, you know, work half the time, let's say on average, during those last 10 years. But, you know, meth's pretty easy to get, and it's not hyper expensive like cocaine or some of the other drugs.
You know the way, and a lot of films, when you see somebody using meth, crystal meth, you see them, they're tweaking, their eyes are massive, and they look like they're ready to actually die. You know, there's 10 and they look absolutely like death. Were you able to manage the way you looked? Were you able to kind of keep yourself a little bit healthy and normal to look at this stage as well?
No. I mean, I was having a lot of, by the time I was 32, I was having a lot of physical problems. You know, meth is toxic, but also my skin was always broken out. I tended to pick at it. I just looked gray. You know, I looked gray and exhausted. And I will say, you know, my memoir, I titled it From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. First of all, because of that trauma substance use connection we talked about, but also I chose to use that word junkie on purpose. I would never use that for somebody else, but I really wanted to make it clear that when I say that I was addicted, I shot meth on a regular basis. And like you say on television, when they show people who are shooting meth, they're always looking like they're in some house with, you know, garbage strewn around them, and they look like they're ready to die. And I really wanted to own that, you know, I was her, you know, that's where I was. I shot meth basically for 15 years. And yet in recovery, you know, not only was I able to be a judge, which is, you know, I'm proud of that, but it was my job, you know, but mostly I have a happy and healthy and, you know, not chaotic life, which is really that it's possible even for people that are struggling at that depth, at that level.
Yeah. How did it all come to an end? So sorry, James, I'll leave you in there. How did it all come to an end for you, Mary? Like, when did you know that, like, this can't go on?
Yeah, so I was 32, so I've been using for 20 years and basically using meth for 15, and the last 10 have been just worse and worse and worse. And so I couldn't hold a job. I was having physical problems. I was exhausted beyond exhausted, you know, hopeless and in despair. And then my partner was ready to throw me out. And so as sort of a last resort, I said, you know, well, what if I go to rehab? And so so when I was 32, I went into a longer-term women's program. It was 90 days minimum, although I ended up staying for 5 months. Turned out not to be the best fit, but that's when I finally went in, when I was 32.
I heard you mention in another interview that you did, when you went into the treatment center, that it worked in many ways, but you didn't really get the spiritual side of the 12-step program that they were promoting inside there. Do you think that your, I suppose, objection to religion and spirituality, maybe objection is not the right word, but you know what I mean. Do you think that might have come from the strong traditional Catholic background and a kind of resentment and a kind of rejection of that?
I don't think so as much. I mean, my mother had actually been divorced from my sister's father, my first father. And so she was excommunicated at the time. So we would go to church on Sunday. We'd go to my grandmother's house and sometimes go to church, but it wasn't a huge part of our life. I would definitely have said when I was young that I believed in God. But as I got older, I realized, well, first I realized I didn't believe in hell. And I thought, well, if you don't believe in hell, you can't really be Catholic. And then I realized, you know, I don't actually believe in God. And that had all happened by the time I was in college. And so when I got sober at 32, that was sort of a resolved question for me. And the 12 steps, you know, AA and all that, I didn't believe in a higher power. So for that reason, it wasn't going to work. But I also didn't agree with turning my will and my life over. I didn't agree I was powerless. And I didn't like to focus on defects. So there were multiple reasons why it wasn't the right fit. I mean, it's a good fit for a lot of people, but it wasn't the right fit for me. And it's not for many. And so it's good that we have a lot of options today and people can find. It was a little harder for me to find the options in 1994 when I got sober. I had to go to the library. Like, there was no Google. You know, I had to get my car and go to the library and do the research. But today there's a lot of options online, including LifeRing Secular Recovery. I'm on the board for them and they have meetings in Ireland. But there's also all kinds of options online other than that. And so it wasn't a good fit. They told me this is the one and only way. And it wasn't true, luckily, because I wasn't going to be able to do it that way. So I had to sort of trust my own judgment and not believe them when they told me that the only option was 12 steps. Because if I would have believed them, I would have given up because it wasn't going to work. But luckily, I thought, well, you know, maybe that's not right. And I tried to listen for the parts I thought I could use, you know, not just to reject the whole thing. And then when I got out of the rehab, I did the research at the library and I found other options and I sort of blended them into a program that worked for me, you know, and has worked for the last 29 years.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point you made. And I think it's important that you said that while you were there, you looked for the pieces of it that would work for you. And, you know, because we can find fault in everything if we want to. And like when you're in the depths of addiction and there's an opportunity to go into residential rehab, you have to try and make it work as best as you can because it's life or death at that stage. And if you went in there and says, oh, all this religious stuff, or I don't want to have my will and life over to the God and left the treatment centre, you probably would not be here today. So like you made a decision, yeah, there are some things here that I find challenging, but I'm going to really make it work. And because there will be people watching this and they'll be thinking, oh, I'm not going to that treatment centre because of this, because of that, because of the other. But if you find, if you go in with that mentality, you'll never find anything that works for you. Do you want?
Well, what I will say is that it's not true that there aren't any other options. If a treatment program says there is no other way, this is the one and only way, they're really lying to you. Because there are other ways. There are many, many, many people who have gotten sober other ways. And so that would always be a red flag for me if they wouldn't acknowledge that there's more than one pathway. On the other hand, if that's the only option on the table for you because that's what you can afford or that's in your local community, then I agree. What you have to do is go in there, be confident that there is a path forward for you. Look for the pieces that will help. Like I looked at that powerless step again, which I didn't agree I was powerless over my addiction, but I thought about it and I said, well, you know what? I can agree that I am powerless to moderate. Like, there's no moderating for me, you know? And I found the one day at a time idea helpful, you know, if I was having a bad craving day. So I agree. If you're forced into a program that's not the right fit, just, you know, trust your judgment, look for the pieces that can help. And then when you get out, you'll be able to participate in whatever program you want, include even if it's online. So we have to work with what's given us. On the other hand, I would recommend that any treatment provider that's listening to this would educate themselves about the options and really refrain from telling people there's only one way because it just isn't true.
You mentioned about the powerless thing there. I remember at the start of my own recovery, I needed people around me that had the same experience as me, who were alcoholics and addicts and whatever. But for the first 6 months, 12 months, all I done was rant inside an AA meeting, just fucking hated everybody, absolutely hated the world. But as I started to grow, right, through therapy, through meditation, through education, through learning how childhood trauma had affected me and how I wasn't able to soothe myself when things went wrong for me, or I wasn't able to process situations and emotions. When I was able to deal with these things on my own level and just accept things for what they were, my life changed. I had the power then, and I still have the power now. I have the power to change whatever day I want to have. Like, if I'm struggling and having a really bad day, right, I don't need to pick the phone up anymore, okay? I don't need to go to an AA meeting anymore. All I need to do is sit down and feel and accept the way I'm feeling. And that's how I deal with my life today, you know? Before, if I was struggling, I would go on the phone, I'd be telling somebody how bad I was, or this person done that and that person done this, and I would be making the situation, just blowing the whole situation up in the air and making it a whole lot worse, and I'd feel worse, and I'm bringing up emotions then from past traumatic things. And when I started to just, this is it, just feel, my life changed. Would something like that be similar to what was going on for you?
Well, I will say that, like you, my trauma recovery, as well as just my sort of bad behaviors, like I had terrible interpersonal skills, you know, I mean, I had a lot to work on when I got sober, besides just being sober. And my trauma recovery was harder and took a lot longer than my substance recovery, because it was older and it was more complicated, right? And so I too, and look, a lot of us, a very high percentage of us, walk into recovery with trauma histories and or mental health challenges.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I had PTSD and I didn't even know it. I had, you know, severe anxiety, severe. And I thought I was just kind of high strung. So I too did that multi-prong attack where I did individual therapy for the trauma with someone with that specialty. And I did meds for a couple of years. And then I did a group, a therapy group for women with trauma histories. And oh my gosh, that was like a whole nother level of recovery for me. And so for a lot of us to really become our best self, to be, you know, to live a happy and chaotic free life, we have to deal with the recovery from both sides of the street, from both our mental health or trauma and our substances. To get to where you are, that's often what it takes.
You know, you know, some treatment centers back here in Ireland, they don't see the correlation between mental health and addiction. They won't take you into a treatment center if it's mental health there. They won't take it, vice versa. Is it something like that similar over in the States?
So when I got sober, Yeah, and when I got sober in 94, what they told us was they wouldn't even evaluate us for mental health for 90 days until we got the drugs out of our system. But today in America, that is not what, that's not the norm. The evidence-based approach is that everyone who goes in for substance abuse treatment should be evaluated for mental health. And really, everyone who goes in for mental health treatment should be evaluated for substance use, because there is such a close interplay. And that the data shows that if you attack both simultaneously, the odds of success are higher. I mean, I think about somebody I know who was struggling with their sobriety because they're bipolar. They were having trouble getting their bipolar diagnosis under control. They're having trouble getting the meds stable. You know, it was like a year and a half before in recovery before their meds for their bipolar was stabilized, and only then was he able to put together really lengthy sobriety. He was having like periods of sobriety during that year and a half, but until his mental health got stabilized, he wasn't able to really get long-term sobriety. And it's a common interplay. I mean, I'm surprised that they wouldn't at least recognize that that we're all better off if both are attacked at the same time. Your odds of success are just going to be a lot higher.
Yeah.
And dealing with an addiction, like all a drug addiction is, or alcohol or any addiction really, it's just a symptom of the trauma. And that's how it plays out. And it plays out like I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Gabor Mate.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we had Dr. Gabor Mate on the podcast with us, which was amazing to have him on, because he's, you know, a brilliant man. And he said that he had issues with shopping and buying CDs and all this stuff that he didn't need. And it was a compulsion. I remember he was telling us that he was delivering a baby, right? And he left the middle of it to go and buy a new, you know, Beethoven symphony thing or something mad. He said he had about 100 of my own. He didn't even open the cases. But it was just this compulsion. But he said it all stems back from his own stuff coming from World War II hungry and all that, you know. So the addiction is only a symptom of an underlying problem. When you come out of the treatment center, that's then when you're met with the behaviors like what you have, the maladaptive behaviors that probably helped you to survive the madness, but they won't help you moving forward. You need a new way of communicating with people. And we always speak about this, like your interpersonal skills weren't great. Like, we had language, it was nearly all slang. Like, we knew how to communicate with each other on the street, but in an office environment or, you know, filling out forms and applications and trying to, you know, advocate for yourself with the social welfare or housing, it's like, how do you speak to these people? What language do you have to use? You know, it's a different way. And that can bring up a lot of anxiety and fear, and the enormity of the task can get overwhelming. And, you know, it's a breeding ground for relapse in those early days, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll say is, for me in early recovery, I was making none of us are perfect, but mostly the right choices, you know, moving forward in my life. But I wasn't actually enjoying my success the way I deserved, because the anxiety was so overwhelming to me. And so even though I was, you know, getting my finances under better control and holding a job and working with my partner, I was doing a lot of the right things, I wasn't able to really enjoy it because I was so caught up in the anxiety from my trauma. I mean, I would spin and spin and spin. God forbid, like a boss should say, Mary Beth, I want to talk to you later. You know, hey, why don't we chat? I'd say very casual, hey, stop by the office later. I mean, my mind is like, I'm getting fired. What did I do wrong? It's just, I was always waiting for my world to explode. I didn't have any faith that things were going to stay good, because I didn't, yeah. I'd never experienced it. It all felt temporary for me. I was always worried one little mistake and they're not going to like put that mistake in perspective, right? I'm going to be judged harshly. It's going to blow up in my face. Everything is going to go wrong. So it was in a constant state of stress, even though I was sober. So it was no way to live in the long run. I would never going to be able to be happy and really enjoy my life the way I deserved until I got that trauma, those trauma symptoms under control.
I can be like that actually on any given day, even today. Like, sometimes I feel like, you know, my life is so much better now in recovery, you know, to be able to do this podcast as my job and to be married and have a care and have a home. And well, I have a kind of recurring fear that would come over me where it's like, somebody's going to cancel us, or somebody's going to, you know, it's going to be whipped from under us in the morning, or what if the funding stops, or what if people stop listening, or, you know, it's like things are so good now in relation to how bad they were. that's like you're nearly afraid to believe it, you know. But actually, you have to kind of come to terms with, no, we actually deserve this, and we're allowed to have these nice things in our life. And life isn't all about suffering and misery, you know. And like, there's no day in addiction a good day, but a bad day in recovery is way better than any day in addiction, you know, because we can manage it. You know, but I want to change direction a little, because education is a big part of your story, and it's a big part of mine and Timmy's story as well. So it sounds like, I know from listening to your story previously that you were doing well in school, even though you were using drugs. When you were always bright, you had a natural flair for academia and stuff like that, and you went into college in your early years. It didn't quite work out for you, but you went back then as a mature student in your early 30s. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I went to college, well, right after high school, except a year delayed because I got arrested. That's another story. But anyway, I went to college a year after I graduated from high school because of my arrest. And that was straight through, and I was doing, I did well. I mean, academically, I did well. I went to Berkeley, you know, which is a really top-tier school.
But it's very famous. Very famous school, isn't it?
But as I said, I started doing meth again in January of my senior year. And so I actually went to law school, Berkeley Law, in the fall, September. But I was so strung out by the time I got there that I had to withdraw. Like, I knew I was going to fail. I knew I lost it because of my addiction. So I withdrew, and that was just this sort of agonizing pain, you know, during the last 10 years of my using that I had been, people would kill for that slot. And I gave it back because of my meth addiction. And so when I got sober, well, first of all, as I said, I worked my way down the corporate ladder. So I had to work back up. And my first job when I got sober was like a part-time, low-level, temporary admin job, because that's all I was really ready for. And then I got a permanent, you know, full-time job, and then a supervisor job. And then when I had 6 years sober, I went to law school for real, you know, and I did end up graduating from Berkeley Law. And so that was like a real, it was a real joy of recovery to be able to get something back that I had, something so important to me, something that I had really intended to do since, you know, I was young. I wanted to be a lawyer, and to get that back in my recovery was a real moment of joy for me. Then I worked as a lawyer for a while, and then a judge.
How did you... No, this is important, because something like this happened to me as well. I went into education at the age of 32 and went through the different routes, and I ended up doing a degree in something that I enjoy doing, which was construction. And because of COVID, the graduation ceremonies were all cancelled.
Oh.
So it never happened. But tell me this, how did you actually feel standing at that podium at the age of what? I don't know, was it 40? Like, just after graduating with a law degree, how did that feel? Like, in 10 years previous to that, you were strung out. How did you actually feel?
I mean, that was a proud day, the graduation, but the moment I remember really is when I got the acceptance in the mail. You know, that was just the moment of pure joy that I actually had managed to get it back. You know, it was just such a, it felt sort of like I'd come full circle, that I was coming, that it was part of returning to who I had originally been, part of returning to my true self, right? Because in my substance use, I had lost that connection. When I got sober, I was cleaning out my file cabinet one day, and I came across my college transcripts, and I was afraid to open them because I thought maybe I misremembered. Maybe I thought I did better than I really did. Because I had so lost my connection to that part of myself that had done well in school, that had been successful. And finally I did open them, and it was like, okay, yeah, okay, that's what I remember. But if getting accepted back into law school, something I had given up because of my meth use disorder, just felt like it was a symbol of coming full circle back to my original self, back to the self I would have been. Sure, it was 16 years later when I started, but at least I was coming back to what I had always wanted to be.
Yeah, you reminded me there. Because I thought back of when I got accepted to go to college, and even before I went to university, I went to a community college for a year. Even like, I remember getting the letter in to say you were on the course, you know, not that feeling of like, oh my God, things is working out, and then doing that course and then getting the acceptance letter to say, I remember when I was even applying for the university college, Cork here in Ormond City, like I didn't even have the money for the application. I had to go to the Cork Alliance Centre, which is a charity that supports people like us. And Sheila paid for the application and helped me with it. And then when I got accepted, it was like, you know, it was the best thing ever, you know. And then along the way, you get little wins, you know. As you build up your experience, you get a job, you get an interview, and then you get the job. And it's like, I think that gratitude for life and those little wins along the way kind of sustain you, don't they? Because, like, for a lot of people, for me anyway, when you're a student like that, like, times are tough financially, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, full-time education is great, but you're not going to have a lot of, you know, disposable income, you know. But it's just getting those little wins along the way really sustain you.
Well, the other thing I'll say is that when I graduated from Berkeley Law, I went to work at a really big law firm, like, you know, the best job basically that you can get. And that to me was, I felt like, you know, I got sober at 32. I felt like I was old. And by the time I graduated from law school, I was 42. I felt like I had lost all this time. And so having that job felt sort of like a way to try to catch up, you know, oh, now I've got this prestigious job and I'm making, you know, good money. But after 3.5 years and going on 4 years, it was really, the hours were crazy. I mean, I was working most weekends and holidays, and we would have theater tickets, and I could hardly ever go. My husband started calling my girlfriend his second wife because she was going to all the things that we bought tickets for. and so at that point, I really started standing back. I remember my therapist said, you know, you've climbed the mountain now, but what do you want your mountain to look like? You know, and at some point I realized, yes, this was an accomplishment. I was proud. I felt like I was making up for lost time, but it really wasn't how I wanted to live my life. And so part of it is giving ourselves permission, you know, to sort of reevaluate where we are intermittently and make sure that what met our needs or fulfilled us in the beginning or at one point in time, is it still working for you, you know, now that it's 2 years later or 3 years later? And I grew up a blue-collar girl. I mean, my family didn't have money. No one else in my immediate family had graduated from college. And so turning back and saying, you know what, I don't want that big, prestigious, high-paying job anymore. It was a real emotional decision. It was hard, but at the same time, I just realized I didn't want to live my life like that anymore, and so I gave it back, and I got a government lawyer job, which was challenging and less money, but it was better for work-life balance. And so I just say that as an example to your listeners that, you know, what meets your needs at one point may not meet your needs later. And it's important to stay in touch with what you want and where you are and make your choices, you know, adjust your choices as you change your mind or you change your feelings about it.
Did you amass any criminal convictions through your drug use, and did that hamper your ability to move on with your life?
I did. So I was arrested in August after high school. So I was supposed to go to college like literally a month later, and I was arrested for hypodermics and methamphetamine. And I grew up in a small town, and so they knew I didn't have a juvenile record. I mean, it probably would have been sealed, but, you know, it's a small town. You know, they would know. And so I was treated really lightly. They reduced my charges down to disorderly person offense, which is like below a misdemeanor. I mean, it's nothing. And when I got sentenced, the judge in my sentencing said that if I didn't get arrested for 3 years, I could get my record expunged. And so that's what I did, like erased. You know, in America, it's called expunged. You get it erased. And so I got it expunged. And then when I was, you know, like applying for the bar, the California bar, let's say, they don't ask, you know, have you ever done drugs? They ask, have you done drugs in the last 5 years or illicit drugs? And by then I had like 10 years sober. And when I became a judge, I had 20 years sober. And I think they only asked about 7 or 10 years. So I was always able to, you know, say no and be honest and say no at the same time. Yeah. On the other hand, I did eventually tell my employer when I was a judge, because I was got on the board of LifeRing and I had to run it through ethics. And so that was the first time I told an employer. But I wrote an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times about how being a white middle-class woman helped me become a judge, because in America, if you're a person of color, your odds of getting stopped when you're driving are a lot higher. Your odds of getting searched if you're stopped are higher. If they find drugs, you get charged is a higher chance, and the charges are higher and the sentences are longer. There's a real racial disparity in the enforcement of drug laws in America. And I wrote an op-ed about that, because the last 10 years that I was using, I had drugs on me every day, and I was stopped for tickets or minor accidents a lot of times, and I was never searched. And so the only arrest I ever had was that one when I was 18.
You know, as a judge then, was it all criminal law? Do you know, when you had people in front of you And you can see that they're drug addicts, and the reason that they're committing some of these crimes is because they're trying to get money to be able to soothe themselves and feed their drug habits and stuff. I suppose you had that extra bit of compassion for them because you knew where they were coming from too.
Yeah, so I didn't do criminal cases, but I did do cases that involved disability and medical. And so I saw a lot of people that had substance use disorder, and I saw a lot of people with trauma, you know, that their behaviors were actually, I knew they were a result of their trauma history, poor decision making, you know, along the lines. And I had certain law I had to apply, which I did. But like you say, I understood where they were, and I didn't make it, you know, unfair judgments about them. Oh, they use drugs, therefore they're a liar, or, you know, the kind of things that sometimes judges do. I just got the information I needed to apply the law, and I applied it the way I had to, and I moved on. I didn't really beat them up about it. But part of the reason I came out as a judge is to really help people have a, you know, to help try to reduce that stigma and increase the understanding that, you know, substance use disorder can hit anyone. You know, when you see people in recovery, you know, you don't even know if they had that history, right? Because in recovery, we look like everybody else. But I did feel that as a judge, sometimes I can get people to hear me a little bit better when I talk about multiple pathways, or about, you know, that we need to help people more than we do. I mean, in America, for example, you can't always get access to treatment. It just doesn't exist for everybody. There's no free, you know, affordable treatment in a lot of communities. And so I talk a lot about the need to help people, you know, no matter where they are. Don't judge them. This is a health issue. This is a medical issue. This is a mental health issue. I was just like her. Let's find some compassion and try to help her.
Do you know in America, like in Ireland, we have free healthcare. Now there's a two-tier healthcare system. So if you have private healthcare, you'll get better healthcare. But if you don't have insurance, you'll still get healthcare. So you're not going to be left to rot. In America, if somebody is strung out, for example, myself, if I was strung out on heroin, and here I can get methadone, can I get methadone for free in America, or Suboxone or stuff like that? Or is everything through private insurance?
So methadone clinics are government, you know, through, well, they have a special license, right? In fact, they just, in America, there's been a lot of sort of bureaucratic rules around methadone, which were just recently eased a little bit. So I don't think people have to pay for their methadone, but it's hard to get. Only about 10% of the people in America that could use medication-assisted treatment, whether it's methadone or buprenorphine or even Suboxone for alcohol use disorder, only about 10% of people get access to it. And so access is part of the problem. And certainly if you want to go inpatient treatment, a lot of people don't have access to that because not everyone has medical coverage. And even if they do, it doesn't always cover it. Plus in America, even if you have insurance, you're lucky if you get 30 days inpatient treatment, like that's the end of it. And they'll push you out. So
yeah, I heard before that the whole concept of 28 days treatment center actually comes from the American insurance companies, isn't it?
Well, when I talk to, like, when I give presentations about substance use disorder, I tell them it's not 28 days because the data shows that's the optimal length of time for treatment. It's 28 days because if you're lucky enough to have insurance, that's what it pays for, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, the data shows that if you have support for 12 to 18 months, you know, that's what you really need to give your best odds. It doesn't have to all be inpatient, but, you know, maybe outpatient or sober living or having access to a mental therapist with substance use specialty or whatever it might be. 12 to 18 months of focused support is really what's going to give people their best chance.
What's your opinion on the liberal drug laws across America at the moment with regards to marijuana?
I mean, I believe in decriminalization of all drugs for personal use. I think there's a number of problems with decriminalization, including the racial disparity, but also in America, the federal government literally defines substance use disorder as a disease, and yet they criminalize it. Like, to me, that's an inherent contradiction, right? You're criminalizing a disease, but that doesn't make any sense. And even if the person doesn't have a disease, because most people who use substances don't, or just, you know, why do I care if they're using it, if they're not hurting anyone else? And there's just a lot of problems. A criminal record First of all, it's more expensive to put people in jail, right? 3 to 4 times the cost to jail someone as to treat them. So that's not a good use of my tax dollars. But also there's a lot of ramifications on their future ability to get employment, to get housing, to get federal benefits, to get education. There's a very disruptive effect of criminalizing something. So I don't believe in it at all.
Yeah. Well, John, when you think about, you know, in your experience, if you were unlucky enough to get arrested a couple of times and you had a conviction, like, your life trajectory would have been so much different, and God only knows where you would have ended up.
If even that first time, if I would have gone to jail that first time and not been able to go to college, I don't think I would have ever gotten back there, or at least not until maybe in my 30s when I finally got sober. It would have completely derailed me. It really would have completely derailed me. And I'm aware of that. And I also don't think that it's helpful in general. I mean, people get out of jail, right? And then there's no care after. They're not giving medication assisted treatment, or they're not giving any kind of help. We just sort of throw them back out and say good luck, and then we act surprised when they pick up substances again and end up back in jail. So it's this vicious cycle that gets created that we don't even disrupt once we get them in the system. So for a multitude of reasons, I have a problem with it.
Do you know when you exposed yourself in the LA Times and other kind of opinion pieces you did for various newspapers, what kind of feedback did you get?
Yeah, my first big public disclosure was in the Wall Street Journal, where I wrote an op-ed, and it was called "I Beat Addiction Without God." And, oh, people were not happy with me. Some of the people were upset that an atheist had been allowed to be a judge, as if this is relevant at all, right? I mean, not relevant. But then a lot of people didn't like me suggesting that there was any option other than 12 steps. Now, I don't mean it to say it's not like no one supported me, but people, you get pushback. I also wrote an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer in support of a safe injection site. And, you know, I understand that people, not everyone agrees with that. It's not that I had concern about them wanting to debate the topic. It's that, you know, when it's online, even if it's in a reputable newspaper, a lot of it gets personal and mean, rather than having like, let's talk about the pros and cons of this policy, you know? So, but yeah, I got pushback, but I was expecting it. So it didn't emotionally bother me for, except maybe the first 24 hours.
Yeah. What's life like now since you're retired?
You know, I'm busy because I do a lot of advocacy work. So I have my book came out in January, but I'm on the board for Life Ring Secular Recovery. I'm on the board for She Recovers Foundation, which is not just substance recovery, but also trauma recovery and mental health and everything else, because it goes together so often. I write opinion pieces to, you know, in a variety of publications, and I speak at radio, television, conferences, podcasts. I speak to a lot of different groups. I talk to a lot to friends and family, and I do training of lawyers and judges about substance use and treatment and recovery options, multiple pathways. So I am retired, and but I'm pretty busy.
What can people find in your book, and if they want to look into it?
Yeah, so it's available on Amazon and all the usual sites. And I'll say, I thought a lot about, before I wrote it, you know, did I have something new to add, you know, to the conversation? And I felt like a lot of memoirs, they sort of start in the crazy stories of addiction. And I show my childhood and what led up to it. You know, why did it make sense for me to pick up alcohol at 12 and shoot meth at 17? And then I do have my years of using, but 30% of my book is about recovery. And it's about basically the first 3 years of my recovery, about how I built a plan, an individual plan that worked for me, but also that trauma recovery interplay with my substance recovery. And then at the end, I have like checklists and guidelines ideas for people to think about. So I really tried to make the book be useful.
Yeah, we linked the book in the description of this podcast, but would you believe you're not the first American judge we've had on our podcast?
No, who else?
We had Judge Wren from Broward County in Florida. He set up the first mental health court in the United States.
Ah, good. Good for him, yeah.
No. But listen, when you're coming off to Ireland, be sure to give us a buzz, and we'd love to get a coffee with you while you're over.
Okay, perfect. I will do that.
And thanks for your time, and yeah, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on all your achievements, and you're a great advocate for people like myself and Timmy and some of our followers. So thank you, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you. Man. Thanks for having me.
Hold up. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.